John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. ISIS's encroachment on the Syrian-Turkish border is our focus this hour. Could it be a test of the Obama coalition against the Islamic State? Pope Francis is testing the flock. We'll hear about that. The Catholic Church may be moving to embrace significant change in the way it views traditional families. We will have another look at waves of social change set off by a single technological breakthrough and the promise of the little people. Short people are just the same. I'm not talking about Randy Newman's short people. I mean children. Their voices and faces are the best energy boost for world-weary grown-ups. Best-selling author and photographer Brandon Stanton will be with us later this hour to tell us how he found authentic faces and voices even in the world's hottest conflict zones. But we begin with the world-weary civil war in Syria. Despite U.S. and allied airstrikes, ISIS continued to advance over the weekend, surrounding the Syrian Kurdish town of Kobani, very close to the Turkish border. Kurdish fighters are trying to hold back an advance by Islamic State militants.
It's in the car! Stop, stop, stop!
Stop, get out, get out!
No, as we were driving away, the vehicle that was coming behind us, the police vehicle, fired a tear gas canister. It came straight through the back window here, filled the back of our truck with tear gas. You probably ought to leave.
That's a dispatch from the BBC's World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams and his crew being tear-gassed by the Turkish police. But those Turks in uniform seem to have been far more aggressive to journalists covering the siege of Kobani than they have up till now been against the ISIS fighters trying to take the city. To sort out what it all means, Paul Adams joins us now from the Turkish-Syrian border. Welcome, Paul.
Hello, John.
So the difficulty now is that ISIS and Kurdish forces are fighting very near the Turkish border, mirroring what was going on in Iraq just a few weeks ago. Can you give us a sense of what's happening?
Yeah, I think as we're speaking, John, Kobani is just teetering on the edge of falling completely. We have seen, we have not yet seen, but it has been filmed, a black ISIS flag flying on the eastern edge of the besieged city. This is 3 weeks now into the siege. There has been intense, heavy fighting along the eastern edge of the city. We've seen that over the past few days. And literally in the last hour or so, we've heard this report that an ISIS flag is flying on those eastern fringes. We also understand that ISIS fighters have taken control of a hill overlooking the city. There's also been a lot of fighting around there. It's clearly an extremely strategic point. And if ISIS bring their big guns up there, then they have the entire city at their mercy. So it does seem as though, slowly but surely, Kobani is falling.
Are the Turkish forces just watching what's going on there? Any sign that they are either threatened or threatened to actually join this fight?
No sign at all. They are there. We've seen a line of Turkish tanks on a hillside just about a kilometer or two from the border fence. But they're not moving. Their guns are pointing towards Syria, but they're certainly not firing. And even though the Turkish prime minister has in the last few days given an assurance that Turkey would not allow Kobani to fall, we are seeing no evidence to suggest that Turkey is indeed going to prevent that from happening. And of course, when you bear in mind decades of bad blood between Turkey and its own Kurdish population, a horrendous war with the Kurdish PKK guerrilla group, which resulted in tens of thousands of lives lost, then you begin to understand why perhaps Turkey might not be exactly rushing to the defense of a town where the defenders are the ideological cousins of the PKK.
What is the humanitarian situation in Kobani, and what are you seeing in terms of refugees and people attempting to escape?
Well, around 160,000 or so people have already fled. Some of them have gone to family members here in Turkey. Others have gone to refugee camps in some of the towns dotted around this area. And when we were at the crossing point, the one managed crossing point yesterday, we saw a few hundred more of stragglers coming in. We've just spoken a short time ago to an official inside Kobani who says that several thousand civilians are still there, along with, of course, a considerable numbers of fighters. And that, of course, presents an awful possibility, which is that if this town falls soon, and bearing in mind the sorts of horror stories one has heard about ISIS and what it does in places it conquers, then I would say there are real fears for the lives and well-being of the people still in the city.
So the expectation is there will be that brutality. It's not the case that ISIS is just sort of moving in and setting up shop, that it's made its point and now it's behaving more like a traditional army.
Well, it's difficult to tell. I spoke to one refugee yesterday, and she had fled from a village, and she said that her father had spoken to someone from ISIS, and that the ISIS fighter had been urging them to stay, but they had decided, for quite understandable reasons, that they should flee. There are all sorts of ghastly stories that we have heard of women being raped, of women and men being beheaded, and also of kind of scorched earth tactics being employed by the fighters as they advance, chopping down olive trees, for example, to make sure there's nothing left for people to go back to. So I don't think people are exactly going to wait to find out if ISIS is in a benign mood.
Paul Adams, BBC World Affairs correspondent, near the Syrian town of Kobani, under siege by ISIS and threatening to fall. Paul Adams, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
An open federal courtroom in Washington, D.C. will be the site of a historic hearing that, while ostensibly focused on a narrow issue of prisoner treatment at the controversial and constitutionally dubious Guantanamo Bay detention facility, today's hearing will be the first public airing of a range of practices that have been challenged for more than a decade. The practice of force-feeding detainees at Guantanamo is the narrow issue, but this hearing will also test a civilian court's authority to review the conditions at the military prison. 149 captives are still held at Guantanamo, even though half of them have been approved for release years ago. Today's hearing is about the case of Syrian detainee Abu Wael Diab, says Carol Rosenberg, veteran Gitmo reporter for the Miami Herald.
This is about one man, a Syrian, who was approved for release years ago. But the larger picture here is that Gladys Kessler, the federal judge, is putting Guantanamo forced feeding and hunger strike policy on trial. We're going to hear her collect evidence about how this prison has been handling the hunger strike that's been going on for about 20 months.
And this is a civilian trial, civil court, federal court system. This is not the judge advocates or the military tribunals, any of that part of the whole judicial infrastructure.
And the great part about that is I get to cover the court today without a soldier leaning over my shoulder or following me around. This is the federal court. This is the U.S. District Court on Constitution Avenue in Washington, D.C. And a civilian judge is going to be looking over the shoulder of the military through a habeas corpus petition and deciding an issue of conditions of confinement.
Now, can she release Abu Wael Diab?
She can't, because the Obama administration has already decided that they're going to do that. She's not deciding unlawful detention issues because the Pentagon and the State Department and everybody agrees this man should not be there. In fact, he's on a short list to go to Uruguay perhaps later this month or in November after they have elections. So the issue, the classic issue of habeas corpus, you know, bring me the body and decide whether he's unlawfully detained, that's over. The administration has already said, we don't want to keep this man. What the issue is really is the daily routine that he's been subjected to of forced feeding, tube feeding, because he's on a hunger strike. The attorneys for this man say that once or twice a day, a squad of soldiers in riot gear go inside his cell, tackle and shackle and carry him to a nurse, a Navy nurse, who puts this tube up his nose and feeds him because he's on this hunger strike. The lawyers say he can't walk because he's got back problems and wants to go in a wheelchair. The attorneys say the military has given him a choice. Walk or we're going to take you through this forced cell extraction. They want the judge to order the third way. They want the judge to say those should not be the two choices this man has to make. And she's going to hear from a psychiatrist and an internist who met the man at the prison under a court order and examined him. And then she'll decide where she's going to go from here. This is a two-day hearing. I don't think we'll learn anything about her decision-making today, but I think after nearly a year of shrinking transparency at Guantanamo, we're going to get some insight into the functioning of this hunger strike. You know, they've been pretty much cutting the public out of most of the basic information on the hunger strike. They don't tell us how many people are on hunger strike anymore. They don't tell us how many people are being tube-fed. We won't get those details, but we will learn about how this man describes what's going on and what's been in his medical records from two doctors who are coming in as sworn witnesses.
Carol Rosenberg, are the lawyers familiar faces from your long time covering Guantanamo, or is it a whole new crew of lawyers?
This might be the first time I see the Justice Department attorneys who are defending Defense Department practice, but these are the same lawyers who've been going down to Guantanamo for years working on these habeas petitions, and they're pretty excited about this. They and a group of the news media, you know, appeal to have this done in open court. The Justice Department moved to close up today's hearing. And I'd say that the lawyers for this detainee are pretty jazzed because they want the public to be able to see some of the stuff that they've seen.
Veteran Miami Herald reporter Carol Rosenberg has covered the proceedings at Guantanamo for years. Carol, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Later, Brandon Stanton, the disarmingly humble photographer and creator of the photo blog Humans of New York, talks about how he has disarmed people all over the world to get pictures of what he calls normal life, something you can find, he says, even in the most abnormal of places.
In places where journalists are so attracted to extremities, images of people with machine guns, images of angry people chanting death to America, to go there and just approach people as they come. Don't seek out the most extreme images. Don't seek out the angriest and most violent elements of a society to depict, but just the normality of a father walking with his daughter. And then find out about those people's lives in an effort to maybe show a more distributed view of a culture and a more distributed view of a society.
Brandon Stanton with us later. His best idea was to bail on being a bond trader a long time ago and become a photographer. Where do you get your best ideas?
My name is Sean Martin. I'm from Oklahoma, and my best ideas always come after I've gone to bed, late in the night. I'll seem to, any problem I've been struggling with, or find a solution, or it'll just kind of come to me.
Hi, my name is Matt. I'm calling from Wisconsin, and the times I do the heaviest thinking or come up with my best ideas is while I'm driving on interstate. I drive for a living, and so I spend a lot of time when the traffic is light, listening to the BBC when I drive at night.
Great ideas, great locations from you out there. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Great inspirations. Coming up, Stephen Johnson talks about how some of those inspired ideas started some unpredictable revolutions that are still going on. Stay with us. May have some good news for some guilty couples out there. Over the weekend, a global meeting of Catholic bishops, a synod intended to address issues of modern family life, began in Rome. It will be a chance for bishops to openly discuss the meaning of something the Pope did a few weeks ago, something you may have missed. Pope Francis performed 20 weddings earlier this year for couples who consider themselves to be living in sin, according to their own Catholic upbringing, people who would traditionally have been considered unfit to wed by the Catholic Church, some who had lived together before marriage, in some cases for years, and others who had children out of wedlock. Is this synod likely to be historic? Reverend James Bretsky, professor of moral theology at the Boston College School of Theology and Ministry, joins me now. Reverend, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
So, you know, I'm out of this, you know, raised a Unitarian, so I'm very much an outsider here. But I suspect the bishops are very much talking about what the Pope's intent was in that marriage ceremony, in addition to all the other issues they're going to be taking up.
Very, very much so. One of the most interesting things about this synod is the amount of very open and at times even acrimonious debate amongst the bishops and cardinals leading up to the synod, besides the usual trying to read the Roman tea leaves. When the Pope does this or the Pope says that, what does that mean? when the opening speech by Cardinal Erdo from Hungary goes this way, what does that mean? So it's quite interesting to watch.
In the way that these bishops operate, are we likely to see some, you know, a big general statement, you know, love conquers all, you know, just be loving and that's just fine? Or is it going to be more of a getting down into the details of, well, if you're living in sin, as long as you do X, Y, and Z, da-da-da-da-da-da, it'll be fine?
Well, I think that would not – somewhere in between those two options. The synod goes for 2 weeks, and the synod is not in and of itself a policy-making body. So what I think I would be looking for is to see what kind of debate is actually coming out of the synod, and I think that's what the Pope's looking for too. I really think he's not trying to get – way out ahead of the group or way behind the group, but he's trying to say, well, where would the consensus seem to be emerging? And it's clear he himself wants to push what he calls the gospel of mercy, the gospel of joy, and pastoral outreach to people who are suffering. This might mean, if he seems to get a certain amount of consensus, it could mean that the concrete rules on admitting divorced and remarried Catholics to Holy Communion could change, but it's not going to change in 2 weeks.
Right. Is this also an example of Pope Francis's political savvy, if we can call it that, in the sense that even beyond the question of family rules and family doctrine, he's really signaling here, come and bring your best ideas. This isn't a climate of fear. This is really much more a climate for open debate, wouldn't you say?
Very much so. And that's what he said in today. Well, it's already over in Rome. In his opening remarks, he said to the cardinals and the bishops' presence to speak without fear, to speak honestly. And that is new. His two previous predecessors, Pope Benedict XVI and Pope John Paul II, I think were very much people who were trying to say, here is the church teaching, it's unchangeable, and we have to bring everyone into conformity with it. This pope is, I think, really trying to open up the possibility of debate and discussion, and he's already succeeded at that.
What would you say the impact is in the Catholic world of a doctrine that embraces all people who declare themselves Catholics in numbers around the world versus trying to figure out who are the true Catholics based on traditional doctrine?
Well, there's a distinction I would make here between what we call doctrine and discipline. So the doctrine is that a sacramental marriage between two Christians is indissoluble until the death of one or the other partner. Discipline is what do you do in the case of this person or that person that doesn't fully correspond to that doctrine. Now, for example, in the United States, up until the early 70s, divorced and remarried Catholics were excommunicated. They're no longer excommunicated, but they are barred from receiving Holy Communion. So that's a discipline. So that could change, especially in the Orthodox Church, where they allow a second marriage if there's contrition over the failure of the first marriage. So that's a matter of discipline. It's related to doctrine, but you have to make that distinction.
Would you say that Catholics around the world, and particularly in the United States, are breathing easier looking at the style of this pope, or is the Catholic Church as irrelevant as polls seem to suggest it is in the United States, particularly in the secular world?
Well, I think many Catholics are breathing easier because I think I work at a parish on the weekends, and one of the parishioners said to me the other day, he has felt, and this is a man in his 70s and a very mainstream sort of guy, you know, he's felt very energized and inspired by the Pope and the direction the church is changing. I think that's what a lot of people are, in fact, inspired by. But there still is a very conservative, loud, and small minority that want a church of sort of like the Mensa Club, you know, just the ultra, ultra observers, the very pure. And that has always been a tension in the church for millennia.
Finally, what will be the result of the ideological prelates and the words in places like Africa and South America that are very, very traditional on all kinds of issues, including the question of homosexuality?
Well, every place has their own kind of flashpoint or burning issue. For example, in Africa, the burning issue really is multiple marriages when you have de facto polygamy, and also what they call marriages by degrees, where a couple will come together, live together, not get married until they have the birth of the first child. So every place has a slightly different issue that is very important for them. Overall, the Pope's atmosphere and his constant rhetoric of going out to the margins, trying to minister to people where they are wounded, I think that's going to play well throughout the world, because everywhere someone is wounded.
Absolutely the case. Reverend James Bretsky, professor of moral theology at Boston College School of Theology and Ministry, commenting on the two-week synod of Catholic bishops that's begun in Rome, in the midst of a sign that there may be some changes regarding traditional family practices in the Catholic Church. Reverend, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
On a crisp fall day, nothing like a motorcycle ride to clear the mind and the soul.
My best ideas come to me 2 hours into an 8-hour motorcycle ride. Sounds and feelings of the road become almost meditative. It's when the good ideas creep out.
That was our listener pal Morgan from San Francisco, who inspired us last week with his On the Road Route 1 meditations. Imagine if one of your best ideas changed the world altogether. The truth is, you can't imagine it. The ideas that really change the world start small and initiate waves of unpredictable change in unintended places, and then poof, a revolution is underway. For most of human history, for instance, dark was dark. If you wanted light, you had to wait until morning. It was also filthy everywhere. People lived with their waste, and if it got dirty, you just moved. But with the growth of cities, the dark got darker and the filth got filthier. Writer Stephen Johnson, the man behind the new book and PBS series How We Got to Now, says, when it all changed, people had no idea how completely that they had been enslaved by darkness and by dirt. Now freed, Johnson says, by light and clean.
In some ways, it may be the single most important set of innovations in the 19th century, in a century that was filled with a lot of amazing ones. But we had this problem in great cities of the world where you had all these people concentrated together for the first time, and multiple millions of people in cities in New York and London and Paris, where people were just dying of epidemic waterborne diseases like cholera. And there were a lot of people at the time who thought cities of this size and this density are just not sustainable. People are not meant – you can see by the fact that 20,000 people in a summer are dying of cholera that something's wrong here. And a host of people, some of them scientists, some of them researchers, some of them kind of civil engineering people and city planners, came together and figured out how to build a modern sewer system, had figured out that the contaminated water was the problem, which was itself a big breakthrough. And through that process – and they also started chlorinating the water, which is a really interesting story. But through that process, infant and child mortality, which was epidemic in the 19th century, has been reduced, tenfold since then, in large part because we have clean drinking water.
But how do you get to the point where you're so terrified of the water because you know that it's filthy – that you would actually do something that's akin to poisoning people?
Yeah.
That's really how chlorination came.
Yeah, there's this great story about this guy, John Leal, who was a doctor in New Jersey. And he had become convinced that small amounts of chlorine in drinking water would kill off bacteria. The kind of paradoxical thing about this is that chlorine is a poison. If you drink a couple glasses of it, it's not a good thing, right? But it turns out that very small doses is lethal to bacteria but harmless to humans. But he knew that basically the authorities and the general public were not going to buy this argument. And so kind of secretly, he ran this big public experiment and chlorinated the water in Jersey City, actually.
And got arrested for it.
Yeah.
Here, I've got the transcript here. The judge says, do you drink this water? Yes, sir. Habitually? Yes, sir. Would you have any hesitation about giving it to your wife and family? I believe it is the safest water in the world. It's a bold move. But luckily for Leal, his gamble is going to pay off in a major way.
But Stephen Johnson, did it pay off for him in that court appearance?
It did. The judge eventually kind of ruled in his favor. But what's interesting, and it comes up later in that transcript, actually, it doesn't pay off for him economically. He never attempted to kind of patent this innovation. It was something he freely released to the world. And chlorination spread across the United States. And because it spread unevenly, one town would adopt it, another town would adopt it 5 years later. There's a great scientific study that was done many years later of exactly the impact on infant and child mortality from chlorination alone, because you can kind of isolate it. And it was basically that it cut it in half. And so when we think about innovation, right, think about we so often celebrate, you know, the Silicon Valley and tech startups when we think about innovation. But this innovation, which no one got rich with and Lille didn't benefit from it economically, but it took this – one of the most horrible things that can happen to a human being, the loss of a child. It took this thing that was incredibly common and made it over time incredibly rare. So I feel like that's the kind of innovation we're trying to celebrate with this show, not just the gadgets, but people like Lille.
Before we go, light is one of your episodes. Yeah. Now, everybody associates light with Thomas Edison and light bulbs, but this is a very different story.
Yeah, we tried a lot in the series to tell stories that people hadn't heard before. And when we had to bring in someone like Edison, who is, of course, central to the story of artificial light, we tried to explain how the interesting thing about the story is that Edison didn't really invent the light bulb. There were 20 people who invented variations of the light bulb that looked very similar to Edison's. And he really built a kind of a system for distributing and metering the power that would power the light bulbs. But we actually started it with the story before that about spermaceti oil, which was the dominant form, the most advanced form of light, a spermaceti candle.
Whale oil.
Whale oil, yeah, from the sperm whale. And you know, the process of extracting this spermaceti fluid from the kind of skull of the whale was amazing. They would kill these whales and then they would kind of carve a hole in the skull of the whale and send like a 13-year-old boy into the skull and they would kind of scrape out the oil. And so this is in, you know, the first half of the 19th century. So it seems crazy, but like if your great-great-great-grandfather wanted to read after dark, a like 13-year-old boy had to like crawl around in the skull of a marine mammal for an afternoon. I mean, that's where we were just like 200 years ago. So it's stories like that that I think are pretty amazing.
Well, Stephen Johnson, the series is called How We Got to Now. He's the host of the PBS series How We Got to Now. He's a science and technology writer. Stephen, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Oh, if little kids ruled the world.
Everybody, I know you can believe in yourself.
I am responsible, honest, dedicated, trustworthy, and creative.
If you believe in yourself, you will know how to ride a bike.
Tonight, boys, that's what you earned here tonight.
I enjoy helping others and seeing them achieve their goals.
If we play them 10 times, they might win 9.
If you don't, you just keep practicing.
One can actually dare to dream such a thing when you hear the innocent voices of kids standing up and taking responsibility there, dwarfed by the podium on stage, but seemingly undaunted by all the challenges ahead in their young lives. Those are some YouTube kids, but their voices may have some of the same impact as pictures, like the simple faces of Brandon Stanton's Little Humans, a book which is out this week. Pictures of young kids facing the camera, full of hope and promise. One of Stanton's books of photographs playing off the popularity of his photo blog, Humans of New York, which itself became a best-selling book last year. Brandon Stanton, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, John.
So kids say it all, right? You don't have to say anything, but wow, there's that face. I mean, I was leafing through your book and it's just every page is hope.
Thank you. Yeah, the photos are, you know, have been gathered on over the last 4 years on the streets of New York, just in the process approaching over 10,000 strangers for the blog. And like you said, I'd say, you know, my two favorite types of people to interview, I think, are very older people and very young people, because, you know, they speak from two opposite perspectives that are, you know, no less authentic. Kids tend to speak from a very, you know, innocent perspective, and, you know, older people tend to speak from a very experienced perspective. And I think you get very interesting answers coming from both sides of that.
But the faces are amazing. I mean, the kids have, you know, all this future on their faces, and it's unknown question marks. Oh, what's that one going to do?
Right, right.
Oh, I can imagine that one doing this, that, and the other thing. And then, of course, the older people, their lives are all there on their face.
Right, right,
and,
right.
No matter what it is, they've done. It's all there.
Yeah, and, you know, especially the 37 that are included in the book are all very outsized personalities. What they were wearing or what they were doing kind of caught my attention on the street out of, you know, the thousands of people that I pass every week, yeah.
In an age of selfies and everybody has a camera, why did you think this would work, that this would connect? I mean, it just seems like...
You sound like my parents.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, you know, I think The Power of Humans of New York, and for those of people who aren't aware of it, you know, I just kind of stop random strangers on the street and I ask them very intimate questions about their lives. And, you know, I think one of the reasons it's become so popular is that so much of social media is stage managed. You know, so much of the media in itself is that, you know, there's the Facebook and Instagram are filled with pictures of people. So what is it about Humans of New York that stands out? It's that, you know, my goal is that in approaching a stranger on the street and having a very in the moment conversation with them, you know, the side of them that they reveal isn't this very carefully crafted image that we put out every day onto social media, but a perspective that might reveal some more vulnerability or authenticity that you don't necessarily find when people are controlling their own image on the internet.
So people with cell phone cameras are behaving like PR.
Yeah.
PR managers of their self.
You know, we've become our own celebrities. You know, it gives everyone a chance to project, like you said, you know, what celebrities, so much of their every move and every introduction to the public is very carefully crafted. And social media has put the tools in our hands to do the very same things with our own lives. And so what you get is a highlight reel of everyone's life. And I guess, you know, one thing I seek to do with Humans of New York is kind of dig below that a little bit and get a moment of insecurity or a moment of vulnerability in a social media news feed where there's nothing but confidence and nothing but success. You know, it kind of stands out, I believe.
Does this work around the world? On this trip, you know, for the United Nations, this is a real test.
Yeah, so I just got back from a 60-day trip around the world, 12 countries including Iraq, South Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo. And, you know, I think it's so funny. Everywhere I went, I would tell somebody where I was going next and they'd be like, oh, you can't do that work there. That place is too dangerous. Or that place, the people there are very reserved and they won't answer. And, you know, what I did find out is that you can stop strangers anywhere in the world and ask them very personal questions about their life. And if you're doing it from a place of genuine interest and authenticity, then people are very willing to talk and almost thankful for the opportunity to share about their lives. And you know the most amazing thing out of all the places I've been, Iraq, Iran, South Sudan, the one place I get rejected the most is New York. You know, I came back for the first day just 3 days ago and started photographing in New York again. And four people told me no in a row. Like, no, I don't want my picture taken. And I just realized that in the past 60 days of traveling to all these, you know, places around the world, some that are quote-unquote hotspots, I had never had that kind of string of rejections.
Spoiled by openness. Yeah. Traveling the world, Brandon Stanton is the photographer for the photo blog Humans of New York. And the humans around the world that you describe being so open, I suspect they might have wanted to know who the heck you are. I mean, did people in Congo, for instance, try to ask, are you a reporter? You're with something.
Right.
How did they do that? Give me a story.
Well, I mean, Congo is – and it was the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Right, right.
I have to be careful about making that distinction. The places where there's more of a security state, the more questions that people have because there's a natural distrust of cameras. There's a natural disgust of people asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good example you pulled out because that was a place where, yes, people were very, very curious what I was doing. And maybe the kind of atmosphere in the security state limited the authenticity of the answers I could get a little bit because of the level of distrust. But, you know, other places, especially the middle...
Well, what did they ask you in Congo? Give me a face, without giving a name.
Yeah, it was more the face than the thing. It's just... there was a lot of, you know, I had a fixer with me at all times that would kind of, I had my credentials there. I would, and there were plenty of times in the Democratic Republic of Congo where, you know, people would come out of nowhere, security forces, like, what are you doing? You know, no, around government buildings and things like that. So there's, you know, there's this kind of, you know, tension and instability that's different than walking up to people in kind of Central Park.
Did your mom worry you were going to end up in the photo blog of ISIS on your little trip?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. I mean, so how'd you deal with it?
Yeah, the short answer is, of course. Well, you know, in Iraq, in Kurdistan in particular, you know, it wasn't a place where, you know, it was a different kind of fear, I guess, because, you know, even though there was a quote unquote threat, the threat was on the other side of a front line of Peshmerga fighters. So, you know, it's not like anywhere somebody could have popped out.
But plenty of moments that we're likely to see from your trip around the world?
Right. You know, my goal was to go into places that have nothing but really bad headlines coming out. And not in all the places I went were this. But and not show optimism or not show hope, but just try to show normalcy. In places where journalists are so attracted to extremities, images of people with machine guns, images of angry people chanting death to America, to go there and just approach people as they come. Don't seek out the most extreme images. Don't seek out the angriest and most violent elements of a society to depict, but just the normality, a father walking with his daughter, a grandfather playing with his grandson, and then find out about those people's lives in an effort to maybe show a more distributed view of a culture and a more distributed view of a society.
Brandon Stanton, photographer and creator of the photo blog Humans of New York, just back from a trip around the world. Brandon, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Brilliant, simple idea there from Brandon Stanton. Where do you get your best ideas?
This is Elle Green. I am currently in New York. My best ideas actually come when my mind is just still. Long drives home, after doing yoga, first waking up in the morning, and while showering.
Bunch of great idea generators out there. Tell us where you get your best ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.